Would they please stand?
Wonderful.
Good. Good seeing you. Thank you for coming. You may be seated. Students are here with a national award-winning program sponsored by the State Bar and the Supreme Court. We invite students from around the state to come and join us for an oral argument. They may have materials relating to this case. They may engage in some activities relevant to the case. They come to oral argument, and after the second oral argument at the lunchtime, they meet with a justice assigned to meet with the students that day. Everyone's invited to that meeting. It's not limited to the students. The subject of that meeting will be the procedures of the court. That is, how we take cases, how we decide cases, and how we distribute and circulate cases and how they are made public. Let me, if anyone wants a summary of the case we're about to hear, would you raise your hand and we'll give you a summary. Let me introduce the court to you all. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. You will meet with Justice Bradley today after the hearing on this ends. Seated next to Justice Bradley is Justice David Prosser, and to his right is Justice Annette Ziegler. To my immediate left is Justice Pat Crooks, and to his left, Justice Patience Robensack, and on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I'll call our second case today, 2013 AP 2435 CR, State versus Fernando Ortiz Mondragon. And this case is related to an earlier case we heard today. We have representing the defendant, Michelle L. Velasquez, Assistant State Public Defender, and representing the state of Wisconsin, Nancy A. Nowit. Ms. Velasquez will have 25 minutes and then 5 minutes in rebuttal. And Ms. Nowit, you will have a half hour. It's later than we usually begin because we ran over on that first case. It's now 10 of 12, and at least my present plan is to hear Ms. Velasquez and then recess for lunch, come back at 1:30, and then hear you, Ms. Nowit, and Ms. Velasquez, and we have a second case. So we're running substantially late today. Both of you can come back after 1:30? Okay. We'll start with you, counsel. Assistant State Public Defender Michelle L. Velasquez.
May it please the court. My name is Michelle Velasquez, and I represent the appellant petitioner in this case, Fernando.
Your voice is soft. You're going to start getting messages from counsel that they can't hear you, so you're going to have to speak into the microphone and see how we do, okay? And speaking slowly helps, too.
I represent the appellant petitioner in this case, Mr. Ortiz Mondragon. Mr. Ortiz Mondragon pled no contest to substantial battery domestic abuse. Unbeknownst to him at the time of entering his plea, doing so foreclosed from him the opportunity to remain in or return to the United States, resulting in separation from his children and family. Specifically, Mr. Ortiz Mondragon pled no contest to a crime involving moral turpitude. And because this crime is punishable by more than 1 year of imprisonment, his conviction rendered him ineligible to apply for cancellation of removal and also rendered him inadmissible to the United States. Under Padilla versus Kentucky, Mr. Ortiz Mondragon's attorney had an affirmative duty to provide for him specific advice of the consequences which would result from his plea. The elements of substantial battery domestic abuse under the Wisconsin statute are consistently found to constitute a crime involving moral turpitude. Reasonable defense counsel would have had to look no further than the elements of the Wisconsin statute and applicable immigration law and case law defining crimes involving moral turpitude to make that determination. Had Mr. Ortiz Mondragon been aware of these severe and permanent consequences, he would not have entered his plea. As alleged in his post-conviction motion and his briefs on appeal, he would have first attempted to negotiate an immigration safe plea. And by that, he means a plea which would not have these certain consequences, a plea that would leave a door open for him to remain in or return to the United States. Had a resolution been unable to be reached, he would have insisted on going to trial. Padilla versus Kentucky changed the landscape of the Sixth Amendment by requiring defense counsel to provide immigration advice. However, it didn't change the test for determining whether or not counsel performs deficiently. The Padilla court recognized that the United States Supreme Court has long held that immigration consequences are a particularly severe punishment and consequence intrinsically intertwined with a criminal conviction. Under Strickland, defense counsel now has to have a reasonable working knowledge of the applicable immigration law in order to provide his or her client with advice about what will happen if he or she enters a plea or is convicted of a particular crime. This responsibility of defense counsel is directly related to the longstanding principle of and responsibility of trial counsel to ensure that pleas are entered knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily, and that criminal defendants are advised of all the applicable penalties in order to make an informed decision about whether or not to enter a plea.
Counsel, does this require the public defender's office to adjust their internal policies and assign only those lawyers with a demonstrated knowledge of immigration law to those who apply for public defender representation that may need that advice?
I think that in response to Padilla versus Kentucky, the Wisconsin State Public Defender, from my experience, and I think the criminal defense bar, as well as immigration attorneys, have responded to Padilla versus Kentucky with the notion that attorneys must have a working knowledge. I think that one of the responses of the Wisconsin State Public Defender has been to use a screening tool up front so that the status of a defendant or of a client is known right from the start of a case. This is an important point, I think, because the Padilla decision specifically contemplates that counsel use their client's immigration status and potential consequences in the plea negotiation process in order to try and mitigate, where possible, any immigration consequences. If counsel is unaware of a client's immigration status before entering a plea or advising to enter a plea, I think that counsel's performance would be deficient. In this case, there wasn't a Mockner hearing, so we don't know from the record as it stands what defense counsel knew or asked about Mr. Ortiz Mondragon's status. However, there is indication in the record at the plea and sentencing hearing, I believe it's on page 11, where the circuit court asked defense counsel, does your client have an ICE hold, Immigration Customs Enforcement hold, or a detainer? And counsel's response was, I think so, I'm not sure, I get information secondhand. I think that's an indication that counsel wasn't truly aware of his client's immigration status or his client's goals to try and avoid or mitigate immigration consequences. And I think that is indicative of deficient performance, not just under Padilla versus Kentucky, but under the Sixth Amendment and Strickland and all of the cases that have come after it, requiring defense counsel to be able to provide legal information and advice necessary to further their client's goals. Defendants are entitled to the advice of competent counsel before giving up their right to a trial. And in this case, Mr. Ortiz-Mondragon was denied constitutionally competent counsel because counsel failed to have a discussion with him about the specific consequences of entering this plea.
What did defense counsel tell the defendant about this issue?
Based on the record, the only information that defense counsel likely gave Mr. Ortiz-Mondragon is the generic language contained in the plea questionnaire and waiver of rights form, which is the same language that circuit court judges are required to give. Upon an entry of this plea, you may be deported, excluded, or denied naturalization under federal law. Padilla contemplates much more than that. Padilla contemplates that, or tells us, really, that counsel has a duty to give affirmative advice where the consequences are clear. And I think that in this case, the consequences were clear. And the Court of Appeals decision, and I think it's the state's position, is that a crime that belongs to a broader category of crimes can never be clear. And I think that that's an incorrect conclusion. First, Padilla doesn't make that distinction. The facts of Padilla were a drug trafficking case, so the immigration statute outlines controlled substances. The immigration statute also has other immigration consequences for other types of criminal convictions, including crimes involving moral turpitude. The statute itself is clear as to what the consequences are if you are convicted of a crime involving moral turpitude. The next step that reasonable defense counsel would have to undertake would be to determine whether or not a particular crime will fall into that category. And in this case, I think it would have been clear through the relevant research of the statute and the applicable case law that the elements of substantial battery in Wisconsin, which require an intent to cause bodily harm and the actual causing of substantial bodily harm, those are the elements. And I think that would have been clear. Counsel would have had to look no further than the elements of the Wisconsin statute and analyze that against the applicable case law.
Counsel, let me interrupt you, if I might, for a minute. When I looked at the decision of the Court of Appeals here, the Court of Appeals found that defendant did not identify clear authority that any crimes for which he pled guilty were crimes of moral turpitude. Now, wouldn't he have to do that in this circumstance? And yet the Court of Appeals said he failed to do that. That's basically what the trial court said as well. How do you get around that?
The trial court and the Court of Appeals only looked at the immigration statute. And because the immigration statute is federal, it's not going to list the categorization of every criminal offense in every state. The decision of the trial court and the Court of Appeals didn't take the next step, which I think we can reasonably expect counsel to do, which is to do some research. What does a crime involving moral turpitude mean? This is a term that's been around for a very long time, and there are many federal cases and Board of Immigration Appeals decisions that interpret that term. And so had counsel done that, he would have discovered that an offense that contains an element of intent to cause harm and actually causing physical harm will be categorically a crime involving moral turpitude.
Do the statutes involving immigration and deportation define the term moral turpitude?
The statute does not define moral turpitude. However, I think it's reasonable from a lawyer's training and experience to look beyond the statute to try and determine what does this term mean? How does this term apply to my case? And I think going back to Padilla is an interpretation of Strickland. Padilla says the penalty, immigration consequences are a penalty of a crime. And now, criminal defense attorneys, you are required to give affirmative advice when the consequences are clear. And we assess counsel's performance under a Strickland analysis. So the analysis of counsel's performance on whether or not it was deficient doesn't change under Padilla versus Kentucky. There's just another layer, and it's something else that criminal defense attorneys need to know. I also think it's important to consider, going back to Justice Rogan's next questions about giving these cases to individuals with a specialized knowledge. Counsel is not required to take on any client in particular. If defense counsel does not want to enter the world of Padilla and trying to advise a non-citizen client of the consequences of his or her conviction, he doesn't need to do that. But if that is undertaken, then there is a responsibility, there is a duty to be able to provide specific advice. Crimes involving moral turpitude isn't necessarily something that defense counsel can't know. And I think that the Court of Appeals decision ignores the requirements of Strickland and what is reasonable, what kind of research is reasonable under the weight of prevailing professional norms, by categorically saying that a crime which would require counsel to look at federal case law or Board of Immigration Appeals decisions would be not clear and succinct. Then what would happen, for example, if the Seventh Circuit made a decision that a particular Wisconsin crime was categorically a crime involving moral turpitude? While that crime might not be listed, it won't be listed in the immigration statute, there would be a clear answer found in the case law. And according to the Court of Appeals decision, we would not require defense counsel to find that case. I think that contradicts the longstanding principle that counsel is there to provide advice, to engage in the kind of analysis and legal research that would be necessary to provide his client with that advice.
Could you clarify for me? let's take criminal damage to property. Okay. And if that were the sole charge here, give me the methodology of trying to determine whether that's a crime of moral turpitude.
So the methodology for determining a crime involving moral turpitude is called the categorical approach. And it examines the elements of the offense. It doesn't examine the facts of a case. It examines what state statute is this person convicted of. And if on the face of that statute, a court can make a determination that a crime is a crime involving moral turpitude categorically, the analysis ends. And regardless of the facts, individual facts of a case.
But let's say we have to have an argument before the court, and I'm representing the defendant. Where do I look that tells me, yep, criminal damage to property is a crime of moral turpitude or is not? Where do I look?
Since Padilla versus Kentucky came down, I think that defense bar and immigration attorneys, national organizations have worked collaboratively to publish and disseminate information to defense bar so that they have reference guides, so that they have resources from which to sort of find the answer quick. It's not necessarily always a quick answer, but things to look for and how to determine it. I don't know off the top of my head if there's a Seventh Circuit case that says criminal damage to property in Wisconsin is a crime involving moral turpitude. Of course, if there is one, then that would be the case to look for it. But this is really asking counsel to look at the elements of the offense and does it match these the definitions that the resources and the research out there would show are crimes involving moral turpitude, which always have an intent element. crimes involving moral turpitude are not negligent crimes. They are intentional acts. In this case, counsel should have also considered the length of the possible punishment. Wisconsin is clear that this is a felony, so the possible punishment exceeds a year of imprisonment. The reason that's important is because there is an exception. So conviction for a crime involving moral turpitude doesn't necessarily result in automatic deportation. There are exceptions. One of the exceptions is called the petty offense exception. As I've discussed in my brief, for crimes that are less than a year of possible punishment. So counsel would have known that if this crime is one involving moral turpitude, just the penalties alone will take it outside of the exceptions. There's nothing in the record to show that there was any meaningful advice or discussion between Mr. Ortiz Mondragon and his defense attorney regarding his immigration status, his goals of remaining in the United States, and what could happen in this case. And I think those generic warnings that the trial court and the Court of Appeals accepted as demonstrating counsel performed adequately by providing a general warning just aren't enough here.
Well, let me ask, excuse me, attempted substantial battery or substantial battery as a party to the crime? I mean, what about those things?
It would depend on the elements of the offense. So that's the first step in the methodology of the categorical approach, are the elements of the offense. If an immigration judge cannot make a determination based on the elements of the offense, the crime of conviction, the next step would be to look at the record of conviction. The record of conviction would include things like the charging documents, which in Wisconsin would have, of course, the probable cause section, which outline all of the alleged violations, all of the facts of the case, so that a judge could then sort of look at what's alleged to have occurred or what specific acts. Crimes involving moral turpitude, I think, become more unclear when there are statutes that are divisible. But this isn't the case here. The statute isn't divisible. There's an intention. There's an actual causing of harm. There was no Mockner hearing. So what, if any, steps counsel undertook to find out these answers is unknown. I think that a rule that suggests clarity only comes when a crime is listed in the immigration statute, again, contradicts what the Sixth Amendment says counsel's duties are generally to their clients.
Okay. It seems to me what I hear you saying is that if this is a crime of a moral turpitude, then it's clear and succinct that deportation removal will follow. Is that correct?
Correct. The immigration statute outlines the consequences for a conviction of a crime involving moral turpitude.
The Court of Appeals says, hey, it's not so clear and succinct that this domestic violence crime is a crime of moral turpitude because moral turpitude is not defined. And so if I just look at the statute, I'm not going to know that the penalty here under the immigration law is, and I'm just going to use deportation as short for removal, non-entry, et cetera. And the Court of Appeals goes further and says, hey, if the attorney can't find out right from the statute whether this crime makes the person deportable, if you can't, then the lawyer does not have to do additional research to find any decisions from around the country.
That's correct. That's what,
that's what the Court of Appeals says. So it is not clear from the statute that this is a moral turpitude crime because it's not listed. It doesn't say domestic violence equals moral turpitude. And that there's no requirement that the lawyer, defense counsel, examine the cases. That's what the court says, I think. And then the court goes further and said, even if you had examined the cases, defense counsel, you didn't find cases that show domestic violence as moral turpitude. Indeed, you didn't even tell us, you didn't give us examples of cases that find DV convictions are moral turpitude. And then they say, well, you gave us case A, B, or C, but that they don't prove your point. And that's on paragraph 12, I think, of the Court of Appeals, in which they go through the cases. So this is an approach to Padilla. It says, okay, the U.S. Supreme Court says if it's clear and succinct, then the penalty consequence is clear and succinct. The defense counsel has to tell the defendant in no uncertain terms, it's clear and succinct, you are going to be deported if you plead guilty to this. Right?
Correct.
And then they say, okay, we're going to apply that test as the Padilla test. And this case doesn't fit it because it's not clear and succinct from the statute, and you don't have to look at the cases, and even if you did look at the cases, they don't support it.
I don't think Padilla says you don't have to look at the case law applicable in any particular circumstance. Padilla just so happened to be a case where controlled substances were listed in the immigration statute. The Court of Appeals decision in this case, again, says that you don't have to look at federal court cases or Board of Immigration decisions that interpret what a crime involving moral turpitude means. And I think that's a basic principle of statutory construction is what does the language of this statute mean? How have courts interpreted this terminology? And what does it mean for my case? I think that Padilla doesn't make a distinction between cases that are crimes that can only be found in the statute and broader categories of crimes. And again, sometimes it will be unclear whether or not a particular crime falls into that category. But in this case, reasonable research would have shown that the elements of substantial battery domestic abuse in Wisconsin are consistently held to be categorical crimes involving moral turpitude. There isn't a Seventh Circuit decision that addresses Wisconsin statute, and I think there are two reasons for that. First of all, I think it's just generally accepted that this is a crime involving moral turpitude, and this isn't something that's being litigated in the immigration courts. I see that my red light is on. If I can complete my last thought.
Yes, you can summarize that and answer any questions that are said.
And I think that the second reason that there isn't a Seventh Circuit case may be very well that the majority of immigration defendants aren't represented, so there may be less litigation. Nonetheless, reasonable research would have revealed that this is a crime involving moral turpitude, and counsel's failure to give advice that this would trigger these specific consequences as outlined in the statute is deficient performance. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Norwood, we finished that in right time. You've argued this before. How long do you think you're going to take? I know you don't know the questions that are going to be asked, but
yeah, not anticipating questions. Certainly, there's overlap.
Can you imagine?
Uninterrupted.
Be clear and succinct, would you?
Exactly. Okay, I'm going to call it that you're going to proceed. Bearing in mind.
I will.
Eat at 1:30. Thank you.
Well, this case, unlike the prior case, is one where the consequences of a plea are not succinct and clear. That's what the Court of Appeals found. That's what the trial court found. And I think both courts were absolutely right. Padilla says in the majority opinion, there will undoubtedly be numerous situations in which the deportation consequences of a particular plea are unclear or uncertain. The duty of the private practitioner in such cases is more limited. When the law is not succinct and straightforward, a criminal defense attorney need do no more than advise a non-citizen client that pending criminal charges may carry a risk of adverse immigration consequences. And in this case, although admittedly there was no Mockner hearing, I believe Mr. Ortiz Mondragon, I hope I'm getting close to the right pronunciation, I apologize if I'm not, conceded he had been given that general warning per the plea questionnaire, and it was consistent with the court's warning under 97108(2). You may face these consequences. And boy, if reading through my brief discussion and even opposing counsel's doesn't make clear how murky crimes involving moral turpitude are, I don't know what else would. It has been described as murky, and even in more unfavorable terms by a variety of courts, it is. And in this case, it couldn't be more true. Interestingly, I read the circuit split on an attorney general opinion from 2008, Silva Trevino, about the methodology. Justice Prosser asked about the methodology of determining what is a crime involving moral turpitude. And in that opinion, the attorney general came up with a three-step framework for how to do it. I'm not going to go through those steps because as recently as December, the Seventh Circuit applied that three-step process and found that fleeing was a crime involving moral turpitude in an opinion that in many ways to read because these cases are, I think I'm a smart person, but this stuff hurts my head.
Counsel, may the record reflect that you, the court takes judicial notice that you're a smart person. Okay.
Thank you.
Nevertheless, up until this decision, dealing with fleeing, the Seventh Circuit said fleeing is a crime of moral turpitude. A smart person might say, boy, it's not clear and succinct. But now that we have a Seventh Circuit case, and we're governed by it in terms of the interpretation of the federal law, we have a Seventh Circuit case that says fleeing is a crime of moral turpitude. Is that now, for a Wisconsin practitioner, clear and succinct?
I will say no, and here's why. The methodology the court employed in that case, citing the Silva Trevino Attorney General's opinion, is now affected, and we'll have to see how and why, by an April 10th, 2015 order from Attorney General Holder vacating Silva Trevino in its entirety. This is the rabbit hole. This is how immigration law changes on a dime. I have a friend, shout out to Robin if she's listening, she said she might do so, who practices in the field and has been kind enough to help me with information. It's a moving target.
Okay, and I'm not familiar with this attorney general order.
prior to that, if we have binding precedent from the Seventh Circuit, or if we have precedent from the Seventh Circuit saying fleeing is a crime of moral turpitude, or let me pick something else, saying that battery, domestic abuse, is a crime of moral turpitude, even though it may not be enumerated in the U.S. Code, it seems to me that until modified or altered, that that is clear and succinct for a Wisconsin practitioner. What do you think?
That could well be if the case is on all fours and it's specific on a categorical approach to analysis of the statute at issue, yes.
So if there's case law that says it and the case law isn't altered, then even though it's not enumerated in the U.S. Code, 1227 or whatever it is, it still would be clear and succinct. I understand in part from the Court of Appeals analysis here that it said, look, we've looked at the U.S. Code and it's not enumerated, unlike Padilla, you know, trafficking of drugs, which is. So end of discussion, pretty much. If it's not enumerated, it's not clear and succinct. Is that what the Court of Appeals said?
I think the Court of Appeals said, and by the way, can I give a caveat to my answer that, yes, it would be controlling in Wisconsin. It would be if it's applying the Wisconsin statute. Seventh Circuit, of course, goes beyond that, and Illinois' fleeing statute That's may right. well be different and could alter
That's right. But if the elements are the same anywhere, I mean, if they are really verbatim elements, you know, oftentimes they are, then if they look at the elements, they're verbatim or the to Wisconsin statute or our Wisconsin statute, then it would be clear and succinct.
The elements of?
Whatever crime it is that's considered to be a crime of moral turpitude by the Seventh Circuit.
Well, so you're talking about the state statute or its federal counterpart, the generic crime, so to speak, to which the state statute is compared, because that is how this kind of analysis generally takes place, not just...
I'm not talking about the crime that's enumerated like Padilla was, or like the prior case today, the Shatta case is. I'm talking about a case that's not enumerated. I understood the Court of Appeals decision to say, essentially, if it's not enumerated in 1227, if I have that right, I can be more specific, but if it's not enumerated in with its subdivisions, then it is not clear and succinct. The Court of Appeals went on to then just additionally indicate it's not even defined in the code, that is, what moral turpitude is. My problem or concern is this. I'm not sure the Court of Appeals is right if that case is interpreted as saying if it's not listed in the federal code, it's not clear and succinct.
I think crime involving moral turpitude is listed. And so I don't think the court is saying, I mean, because it's listed.
I don't mean that. I mean the specific nature of the crime. Unlike in Padilla, I must not be making myself clear. Unlike Padilla, the statute and the Shatta case, you have the specific statute listed, that is, enumerated in the U.S. Code. The trafficking of illegal drugs was listed as 12 in violation of U.S. Code 1227A2B1. It's specifically listed there. Crimes of moral turpitude are not specifically enumerated in 1227 in any subcategory of 1227. Therefore, I understood the Court of Appeals' opinion to be saying if it's not specifically enumerated, unlike in Padilla, 1227A2B1, then it's not clear and succinct.
I think maybe a better way to say it would be if it's not sufficiently defined, either there by virtue of being enumerated and specifically defined in the statute, or by case law. The case law across the country is all over the board. And even within the Seventh Circuit, is changing rapidly.
Do you think we are guided by the different federal circuits? I thought that our analysis would only cover the Seventh Circuit.
Well, I mean, as you know, and counsel pointed out, there's no Seventh Circuit decision interpreting Wisconsin's substantial battery statute in terms of whether it's a crime involving moral turpitude. And so what do we do then? We look elsewhere, and elsewhere is all over the place. Mm-hmm. So succinct and clear, no way.
I think she said also what you do is you look at the elements of the offense. That's really what you're doing. Yeah. But that's okay. She said what she said.
Yes, but even there, those elements as interpreted, they're different, by the way, across the states. So you first have to start with the state statute where the offense occurred. Then you compare it to the generic crime, what the crime is generally, you know, thought to be at the federal level, then you see whether the statute actually matches or doesn't. There's this categorical approach. There's the modified categorical approach. It's the rabbit hole again.
It seems to me you're now saying that the state thinks we should apply the Padilla standard of clear and certain, clear and succinct. And if the statute is, if the immigration statute is clear and succinct that this guy is going, then the lawyer has to give advice. You're out of here. If the statute, the federal statute, is not clear and succinct, then defense counsel doesn't have to give definitive advice that you're out of here. The defense counsel can then say what our statute says. I always refer to it as the Duamanga statute because that was the case that upheld that statute. Or what the plea questionnaire says. The language is a little different. I think it's could or would versus may, but essentially they're the same. And that your position is, in this case, it is not clear and succinct in the federal statute that domestic violence in the Wisconsin statutes is a crime of moral turpitude.
It is neither clear in the statute nor in the case law across the country and specific to Wisconsin.
I accept that modification. So if I did intensive research, I'd still come up wanting that I couldn't say for sure.
Yes.
So then you'd apply the Padilla, clear and succinct, say here it is not clear and succinct about moral turpitude, looking at the language of the federal statute, case law, and whatever else. I mean, we'll just throw in the whole pot, just for the heck of it. And that since it's not clear and succinct, counsel can give a less than definitive opinion as to the chances of deportation.
According to Padilla's language, yes.
That's what I'm saying.
Carry a risk of adverse immigration consequences.
You're saying let's just follow the majority opinion in Padilla here. Let's use that as a standard. Apply it to the facts of this case, and you come out affirming the Court of Appeals and trial court, if I understand your position. I'm just trying to really understand your position.
Yes, I think that's accurate. I think it's easier to apply Padilla in this case in some ways.
And my answer to you, of course, is if Padilla is the law, then you have to apply it in all cases. It may be harder to decide whether it's clear and succinct, but you've got to apply it.
I apologize if I misstated something and led you to believe I don't think Padilla applies. It certainly does.
Okay, so Padilla is the standard. I mean, this is in response to, I think Justice Prosser asked that question, too. It's maybe a different format as to what is the standard. standard that you're going to use. Maybe he didn't. He can speak for himself.
Yep, I'm sorry, Justice Ziegler.
Counsel, under the statute, the court's admonition is that the person needs to understand the plea could result in deportation.
Yes.
Et cetera. And if the defendant wants to withdraw the plea, they have to show the deportation. It was the plea that likely would cause the deportation. In this case, the post-conviction motion was to withdraw a guilty plea. But in this instance, the judgment of conviction was a no-contest plea. Given that an immigration hearing is civil in nature, is it the plea that caused the deportation?
Well, you know, there has been historically some distinction made between a guilty plea and a no-contest plea, but more important, irrespective of the formal plea or even an acquittal on an offense, there have been occasions where courts have looked beyond the conviction of record and assessed a defendant's conduct. Now, that's less likely to happen these days than it had been previously.
Well, in a crime of moral turpitude, they do have to look beyond the actual words, right, of the charge. They look to what happened in the facts, right?
I think often that happens, yes, but it depends on the approach or methodology, as Justice Prosser was getting at earlier. It depends on the methodology employed by the court involved, and that varies by jurisdiction. And it depends on the state statute and how well it marries or matches under the categorical approach that we've been talking about with its federal counterpart, the generic crime. And if it matches, you're done. If it doesn't, sometimes you can move on and consult information beyond. But the crime involving moral turpitude is one that I think invites going beyond the record in a way that other crimes don't because of its viscous nature, if I can say it that way.
This is my concern with the Court of Appeals opinion. It frames the issue, and I'm looking at Appendix 106 that has a copy of the opinion, but it frames the issue in paragraph 8, which is a long paragraph, playing off Justice Alito's concurrence. And I'm going to give you a moment to locate that if you have it.
Paragraph 8 of the Court of Appeals decision? I have it.
Okay. And it's the second block quote, the very end. It says, what if, quoting Alito, what if the application of the provision to a particular case is not clear, but a cursory examination of case law or administrative decisions would provide a definitive answer? Then the Court of Appeals says the latter question, the one that I just raised and read, is at the heart of the issue here. So that's what the Court of Appeals says is the heart of the issue. If the application of the provision to a particular case is not clear, but a cursory examination of case law or administrative decisions would provide a definitive answer, what's the responsibility? That's the heart. And my problem is this. The Court of Appeals says you're not required to do a cursory examination of case law or administrative decisions. And I think any attorney held to a professional standard of competence, especially vis-a-vis the Sixth Amendment, has to not necessarily take an in-depth examination, doesn't have to do a legal exegesis, but to perform at least minimally competent under the Sixth Amendment has to, at a minimum, make a cursory examination of case law or administrative decisions. And in paragraph 12, the Court of Appeals, although it doesn't use the word cursory, says, if an attorney must search federal courts and unfamiliar administrative board decisions from around the country, and then it goes on to say, it's not succinct and clear. And it takes my breath away to think that a minimum standard is not at least doing a cursory review of federal court and administrative board decisions.
I don't read the Court of Appeals opinion that way. I think what the Court of Appeals was saying, you know, what if a cursory review would have given a definitive answer, is in the context of the court's observation that the defendant in this case couldn't do that, provided no citations to authority to establish a definitive answer. Back to your question about fleeing, wouldn't that now be precedent? Yes, he couldn't point to a precedent like that. And so he didn't satisfy that minimum standard. I don't think the Court of Appeals is saying, you can just throw up your hands and do nothing. The court's saying, sure, show me where the clear authority is, and then I might well agree with you that counsel should have known that.
But don't you sometimes, if it's not right in your face, if it's not enumerated, don't you have to search, at least in a cursory, a standard of reasonable attorney professional duty to search federal court and the administrative board decisions? Is there no duty?
I'm not saying that. But, again, I think the key word is reasonableness.
Okay, that's right. I totally agree with you. I think, I mean, I don't know what others do, that it's reasonableness. Yeah. But it's not as though there is no duty. There is a reasonable duty. It's the Strickland duty.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I tried to say that all along, but yes. And in this case, however, it is not reasonable, given the state of the law and lack thereof in Wisconsin, for a defense attorney to know that this is a crime involving moral turpitude.
Maybe it may or may not be in this case, but of course we have a more general responsibility than this case. So what we are looking for are, you know, standards. You know, what's the law? Not just, what are the facts of this case and what's going to end it? What's the disposition of this case? And it seems to me that if it's not specifically enumerated in the federal statute, the federal code, that an attorney has a responsibility to reasonably research, who knows, reasonable under the circumstances, right? That's what we always say.
Yes.
Reasonably research federal court and administrative board decisions to see if it is indeed succinct and clear. Do you agree or disagree with that?
Well, to see if it's succinct and clear, sure, but having come to the determination that it is not,
well,
and in this case I don't think
it is,
I don't think the attorney has to do anything more than what he or she did in
I'm
this case.
I'm going to set this case aside. Doesn't an attorney have an obligation to engage in reasonable research under the circumstances of federal court and administrative board decisions to determine whether the charge fits the category and whether that is succinct and clear? There is an obligation to do some kind of reasonable research, isn't there?
Just generally, I think attorneys are obligated to make reasonable inquiry into applicable law, you know, in the context of the specific crime with which his or her client is charged,
but
what defenses there might be,
but
that
paragraph
kind of thing.
12 says to the contrary. If an attorney must search federal court and unfamiliar board decisions from around the country to identify a category of elements that together constitutes crimes of moral turpitude and then determine whether a charge fits that category, then the law is not succinct clear and explicit. That's my problem. And I would say, look, you know, you've got to do reasonable research. And if the federal court decision says explicitly and clearly that it is a crime of moral turpitude, and if cursory, reasonable research would have yielded that knowledge, then you're held to that standard.
But then, again, where is reasonable? Let's say that precedent comes from another state that defines substantial battery differently than Wisconsin.
But we deal with Strickland, since Strickland came, what is with the reasonableness under the circumstances. That's the professional standard, and to fall below that is deficient in professional standard.
Would a decision of this court, which says that we are not bound by federal law unless announced by the U.S. Supreme Court, so we're not bound by the Seventh Circuit or the Fifth or the First, would that affect what reasonable research would entail?
Well, I think it does, because if it's not binding, is it reasonable for a criminal defense attorney relying on that to advise his or her client according to what that case has to say? That's a tough call, especially when there is so much discrepancy across the federal circuits.
Do you think it makes any difference in this case that while there were removal proceedings commenced, he voluntarily departed the country? He was not removed or deported. But now his question is that counsel should have advised him, or it should be. I mean, it hasn't been mentioned by anyone here yet today. But his real quarrel with what happened is that counsel should have advised him that he would be denied admission to the country.
And they are different.
They are different. I'm wondering if that's worthy of any discussion.
It's certainly something to consider, because although in Shada, I don't think he put admissibility at issue, and yet deportation and admissibility to the country are very different animals. Someone can be not subject to deportation, and in this case, having been allowed a voluntary departure, Mr. Ortiz Mondragon might have some opportunities to pursue discretionary relief and or, you know, depending on the outcome of this case, frankly, be readmitted to the country. But you could, and so it brings up, again, the reasonableness of advice, because you do have to think about that. If we go with what counsel said in the prior case, you will be deported. That turns out not to be the case. It's not just wrong, but the client is inadmissible. He or she could leave the country and then never be able to come back. That could happen. So, yes, it does matter, because they are different, both significant, certainly, but it makes things all the more murky.
No, what I think I'm hearing you saying, not only at this hearing, but at the preceding hearing, our first hearing, which started, I think, about 12 hours ago.
Right to me at this point.
I think what it boils down to is you're asking us to keep the line drawn between what is reasonable for a criminal defense attorney in our state versus what is reasonable for an immigration law expert attorney. And it seems to me that given that Padilla does not say, as you have, first of all, I understand, and I think most of us do, you are saying Padilla is the law.
Yes.
But you also, in the next breath, I think correctly point out that Padilla never says what the lawyer has to tell the client. And if we think about it, it seems to be common sense that the court wouldn't have attempted that, because almost by definition, it's going to vary in at least in degree, if not in kind, in every case. And so that brings us back to the warnings that were given and the warnings that should be given in future like cases, which is your plea could result in your deportation, exclusion, or non-readmittance into this country. And it seems to me the position you're staking out, although you haven't said it this clearly, and if I'm abbreviating it unduly or inaccurately, please let me know, is to say that's enough. That's enough, because anything beyond that is going to be up to an immigration attorney.
That's certainly enough in this case, absolutely. Now, there is the succinct and clear language, and we have to be clear about what that means, but I totally agree. It cannot be what an immigration attorney, expert in the field, would be able to tell you about this case. And it can't be automatic deportation.
Well, the succinct and clear language, Justice Alito pointed out in his concurrence, and I've heard other members of the bench cite to it, that I think he called it that vague test, is going to lead to confusion and unnecessary litigation. And so what might be clear to one attorney, depending on, like, as you said before, what about a new attorney, as opposed to a seasoned attorney who has some depth of knowledge in the immigration field? And so just by invoking this phrase, when it's clear, what more could it possibly trigger that would be a one-size-fits-all for these kinds of cases besides your plea might?
Or could. There can't be a one-size-fits-all. And again, the Padilla majority acknowledges that. Lack of clarity in the law does not obviate the need for counsel to say something about the possibility of deportation, even though it will affect the scope and nature of counsel's advice. So this is Strickland, guided by Padilla, but there's not a one-size-fits-all.
Well, or put another way, the best we can do to fit all sizes is to say could.
Yeah. Something equivocal, not the unequivocal, you will be deported.
When I hear the word equivocal, I think maybe, maybe not, but it could.
Yes.
That puts someone on notice.
Yeah, that's it. And that is equivocal in the sense I meant it, yes.
We don't know what defense counsel told defendant, right? All we know is the plea questionnaire and the judge's instructions.
That's correct. There was no Mockner hearing. That's right.
And under Hoppe, the plea questionnaire is not good enough.
Well, I mean, I think what happened here, I understand where you're going with that. The circuit court accepted Mr. Ortiz-Mondragon's concession, frankly, that he had received that warning. And because of that concession, the circuit court said that was enough based on everything else.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And my red light is on.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, counsel. And we apologize for two back-to-back, but at the last time it happened, I gather you didn't object in mind. Right. Well, you can stay if you like. Counsel?
Just a couple points of clarification first. Mr. Ortiz's no contest plea is a conviction for immigration purposes, just as it is a criminal conviction in Wisconsin, and does not insulate him from the immigration consequences associated with the conviction for a crime involving moral turpitude.
In other words, no contest and a guilty plea are treated the same.
That's correct. The state wants this court to believe that the analysis of whether or not a crime involving moral turpitude is always going to be murky. They point out in their brief, as they did in their argument here, that different decisions from around the country make that clear. However, the state's brief correctly points out that crimes with an element of an intention to cause physical harm and actually causing physical harm against a domestic partner are crimes involving moral turpitude. The only differences come into play when a different state statute contains different elements. We only need to look at the statute in Wisconsin. That's all that's expected of defense counsel in this case. Furthermore, as I discussed in my argument, there's so much information out there now to assist defense counsel in engaging in the immigration analysis. In the appendix of my brief, there is a chart. That chart, I believe it's probably the last thing in the appendix. I'm sorry, I don't have the page site. But that chart has a little box that says, a crime involving moral turpitude is an intent to cause physical harm and causing physical harm. That's a generic definition. Counsel can look at something like that and compare it against the elements in Wisconsin. That analysis doesn't ask too much. It is not an unreasonable undertaking for counsel to engage in some research, some investigation, to figure out the answer for his client, particularly when, as the court in Padilla noted, the immigration consequences are so severe and so permanent that they're likely to most people much more important than any jail time.
Is it the same list of crimes that preclude someone from entering the country as is the same list for deportation?
There is some overlap, but there are some differences as well between crimes that make somebody deportable versus crimes that make somebody inadmissible. But inadmissible is also just the fact that Mr. Ortiz is now ineligible to adjust status or to apply for cancellation of removal. And Padilla recognized the importance of maintaining discretionary immigration relief in its discussion of a law that's no longer applicable, but that defense counsel in the past was held responsible and held to be deficient if they failed to ask for that discretionary relief at the time of a criminal conviction. I think that this court, I'm asking this court to do a couple of things. First, I'm asking that this court not draw the bright line rule that the Court of Appeals has drawn here in saying if counsel has to look at case law, if they have to engage in the kind of legal research and analysis for which they are trained, for which Strickland says they are responsible, that the consequence can't be clear. I think that, again, is contrary to all of the Strickland, the case law out there, and it certainly is contrary to Padilla versus Kentucky. This is here. Padilla requires defense counsel to now have a working knowledge of the immigration case law. And so having to look at other jurisdictions, correct, it's not going to have a Wisconsin statute, but attorneys look outside of Wisconsin all of the time when we don't have a case on point. And when you find something that says the elements of a crime involving moral turpitude are X and Y, intention, causing harm, and you look at the Wisconsin statute, and that ends the analysis, that's a very reasonable expectation of counsel, and it's also a very clear consequence.
My time is up. 8 U.S.C. 1227 is the section that deals with the crimes that are listed for which someone may be deportable. What's the section that deals with not deportation but grounds for denial of admissibility?
Admissibility, 8 U.S.C. section 1182 sub A, sub 2, sub A, sub 1, sub
I. Okay, that's close enough.
It's a long one.
I can find it. Thank you.
There are no more questions. My time's up.
Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Ms. Noah, once again. And thank you, Ms. Gallis, for your discussion of the Padilla issue and its application to Wisconsin counsel in criminal cases. This closes the hearing on 2013 AP 2435 CR, State versus Fernando Ortiz Mondragon. The court is in recess until 1:30, when it will hear our third case. for today. We are in recess. You want me to do it? Justice Bradley will be out momentarily to talk with the students, and I think more students, Mr. Pond, are expected in. We are in recess.